turn to Central 407, please.
So we'll meet Miles at 3 o'clock tomorrow.
Which one?
407. Mr. Graney, you have some post amendments to this? State your name and position for the record, please.
Bernard F. Graney, Chief Attorney for the Veterans Administration Department. Our interest in this bill arises from the fact that we are obligated by federal law to supervise guardianships where the Veterans Administration is making payments. This involves about 1,800 guardianships in the state of Oregon. We are concerned with the bill. However, our only concern is in Article 4, the conservatorship
page,
aspect.
Please.
Page 13. This section deals with the conservatorship aspects. They're not concerned about the guardian of the person. Well, we feel that the general powers in sections 59 to 64 are too broad and will open the door for misuse of funds. We do feel that this can be, to a degree at least, alleviated by three minor changes in the Act. The first would be in the section pertaining to the bond, section 44. Section 44 at the present time makes the bond discretionary with the court. I believe that if this were changed to read that the court, unless otherwise provided by law, shall require a conservator. Changing may to shall and adding the words unless otherwise provided by law, I suggest adding those words because if it is made mandatory by the word shall, we should still provide for the non-requirement of a bond by banks, trust companies, the State Department of Veterans Affairs, and those who are now not required to file a bond with guardianship matters.
Excuse me just a minute. Is there anybody else here on Senate Bill 407? Thank you. Go ahead.
We feel also that that this is necessary because with the much broader authority for a conservator to make investments without the court approval, to sell property without court approval, there will be misuse of funds in an increasing number of cases, and that at least the ward should have protection of an adequate bond when this occurred. We think likewise that the Section 59, which provides that, Section 79, I should say. I should say Section 54. This provides for consent accounting. It provides literally for merely the filing of a receipt in lieu of an accounting at the termination of a conservatorship. Now, I think we all recognize, and the law has long recognized, that there's a great chance of undue influence by a fiduciary over a ward. In these situations, the ward will either be a person who just reached the age of majority or a person who has been under some disability which is now removed, and would feel that certainly it would be in order that there be an accounting approved by the court before the matter is disposed of, and that it should not be disposed of by merely a receipt filed from the person who had been under disability. I think this is particularly true because of Section 64, Section 64 would appear on its heading to apply only to minors, but in fact it applies to all persons under disability. And it provides that when a minor who has been judged disabled under Section 2, who has not been judged disabled under Section 2, which is the disability for mental reasons, has attained his majority, the conservator can transfer assets to him. We have no objections to that. But it also states that when the conservator is satisfied that a protected person's disability other than minority is seized, they can do the same thing. Now this, in effect, makes the conservator the judge of whether a person has been restored, is now competent. At the time of the appointment, it was a decision of the court that the person needed a fiduciary, and we are actually delegating the decision that the person no longer needs one to the fiduciary himself. When you couple this with the non-accounting under Section 54, you can see the a really potential dangerous situation, a situation where a fiduciary, after having misused funds, can convince the ward that they no longer are under a disability, and making that determination, they could then obtain a receipt from the ward, file the receipt, and terminate the whole proceedings. I think that merely eliminating the words in Section 64, or when a conservator is satisfied that a protected person's disability other than minority has ceased to take care of the incompetent person, and by eliminating completely Section 54, providing for the accounting by merely the filing of a receipt, and by changing Section 44 with respect to the bond.
No, this is a work session.
So that
printed amendments.
I have written a letter which in which I have shown the suggested change in 44, and of course making reference to the elimination of Section 54. I did not spell out specifically the elimination of those words in 64. I could send that. It's just the elimination of one phrase. In other words, I see no reason why a minor reaches the age majority. That's a fact. There's no argument. If they reach the age majority, they'll be terminated.
6, 7,
but the question of whether a incompetent has become competent is another question.
6.2 or 5.92. Do you have your amendments in writing?
In a letter form, which does cover the change in 44, and it does state that I feel that 54 should be eliminated. I don't specifically state the word changing in 64. I could send that down. It's merely eliminating the words starting on line 33, or when the conservator is satisfied that a protected person's disability other than minority has ceased.
Would you pass out to me?
Yes.
Are there questions of Mr. Graney?
Sure.
This is from the next page. That's a privacy.
Thank you, Mr. Graney.
I appreciate the opportunity of coming for the committee on this matter. I realize that this was not scheduled, and I'm taking your time. Thank you.
John, do we have other amendments?
Yes, we do, Madam Chairman. There should be in your packet amendments prepared by Janet Merrill from Legislative Council.
Janet here?
Yes, she is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's turn to Representative Peck's bill first. What is it, Grace?
Yeah, those are
696.
The rate's particularly good.
What was that one
we
just
696.
Like you've got more bills, Grace.
So I have all the candy we get.
You are really a prolific bill sponsor.
Absolutely. Madam Chairman, members of the Assembly, you know I was here at one and left my little lifesavers for you at that time.
We knew you'd been here. I saw that.
It's just like the Easter Bunny.
No, I didn't have a favorite.
Now, this bill, the reason I asked Senator Brown to join me in this bill during the interim was it, for some time, I had people complain to me, foster home people, that all of a sudden they didn't get any more foster home kids, or their certification was denied them, and they could never get to the actual reason why. They were never shown anything in their record, and when they denied them care a couple of times, one of them went to, thought she was getting a child, and then it was just pulled away from her right at the last minute. She tried to find out why, but they never let them know what was in the record, what they had against them. And I was a little alarmed at this. I first became aware of it several sessions ago when Mrs. Dyke, the daughter-in-law of former Judge Dyke and related to the representative Dyke, had a child taken from their home just suddenly while she was away and the daughter was home. And she was quite concerned, and some people quit taking foster children, and some that she'd encouraged to do it didn't do it because of this way that they were treated. And so I thought that I tried to get a hearing for this particular, last particular person, and I was unable to do it. Finally, they did grant a hearing with the foster care home group and all. I went to the meeting. They invited me to come, and I, as I've told Senator Brown, I never was treated nastier than I was at that particular meeting by the people from the Children's Services. Just a cool, nasty way I was treated. If I hadn't promised her I'd come, I would have gotten up and left before I did. And when I did leave, I did make the remark that I really, first time I thought I'd ever been treated kind of unfairly by some of the state agency people. But I thought it was necessary to get something in the statute that would provide that these foster parents could see, could be shown that here of those records, or they could have a hearing if they wanted to protest something that was in there. And I asked Senator Brown to join me in this, and then she got a letter from Mr. Miller, I believe, telling her that they were doing this, that and maybe the legislation wasn't necessary. She wrote a little note and asked her whether I still wanted her to introduce this in spite of the letter she sent, copy of the letter she sent to me, and I said yes, I did, because I thought it should be more definite than just a policy at the time. And I know that when Mr. Miller went into the job he has now, he didn't necessarily live up to all the verbal policies that Mr. Galvin had set up, and should Mr. Miller go on somewhere else, I couldn't be sure that the next one would do, carry out what he said. And I think he did say it was on a temporary basis. The some of the foster home people seem to, associations seem to think the letter from him that they'd go ahead and do this was enough, but I don't feel that it is. I feel that it should be in the statute so that any people taking care of foster children have a right to their day in court if they're taken away from them, the certification taken away. This morning we were at breakfast listening to a man from Washington, D.C. on the best way to get out, get foster homes, group care centers, and all going. And I think it's important, and I think we should be, in order to encourage people to take over these kids, we could should assure them that they're going to have the right to such a thing as this bill gives them. Now, I would have to go, get back to another meeting. I would like to ask Carlos Rivero to finish the testimony on this, because he has talked to Mr. Miller and has some data that I didn't have at the beginning of this. But I think this is a good bill, and it should be passed. And if you don't mind, I'd like to have Carlos Rivera, my administrative, finish my discussion, because he does have later information on this than I have.
Well, Madam Chairman, I just, in the interest of your time and his time and the committee's time, I'm going to move the bill out as it is.
Do pass.
Do pass.
Right, that's
what I'm saying. Sure. Senator Weiss. There's a new rules that Children's Division is adopted in this regard. Do we even need the bill?
I think we do.
They said, Senator Hoyt, that the rules were temporary. And some of the experience has been that when we're not in session, they don't always maintain the same policy.
Okay. Well, they've introduced the bill.
Yes, I realize
the policy
that.
Policy change would do it. Won't. I think it should be in the statute that they have to do this, and then they don't pass the buck from one person to another and just keep turning them down, and they don't know why.
That's
I think it's very important.
Sure, Senator White.
In your view, have you seen a copy of the rules? I think we've always seen
I have seen some of them.
Would you say that the bill is pretty much in harmony with those rules? So if we pass the bill...
Well, maybe, but this is what Carlos has all that information to speak better to it, but I still think we need it down the statute. So regardless of change of rules or regulations or heads of departments or anything, it's there to protect the foster parents. And if we're wanting to get more and more foster parents in, because we need to have this protection.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Cook.
Grace, would you feel that the, if this were passed, that the Children's Services Division would have the authority to take the child away first and have a hearing afterwards?
Well, I would think they'd have to give a very good reason for doing it, and they know that the person could take them into court if necessary or into a hearing.
I think it does, and I don't know if there's someone else who can tell me if that is the intent. I think it does would give them the authority to take the child first and have the hearing later.
Well, why would they want to have a hearing if they still have the child? If they take the child away and they won't tell them why they're taking it away, and then they refuse to send any more children to them and won't say why they're refusing to send them, why should this person be able to see their record to know what it's all about? And then they might ask for a hearing.
No, I guess I didn't make myself clear. The only thing that I don't think I have any concern, if I understand it right. I think that the Children's Service Division perhaps should have the authority to take the child first and have a hearing later in the event there were a claimed abuse or some such thing. I'm concerned that way.
They wouldn't gain anything by a hearing. They'd lose if it was a case of abuse.
Section 5, and take a look at it.
Section 5. Well, that concerns me a little bit, with this Section 5 in it. I don't know, but I'd be a little bit concerned about the possibility that, there have been foster parents who haven't, and they're rare maybe, but who haven't treated the child as well as they might have. And I'd be a little concerned with the possibility of the child, there's no way for the child to get out of the home without a hearing. I don't know if that's...
Well, I think if this happened, they took the children. Then they refused to tell the people why they took the children. And then when they wouldn't send any more children to them, and when they even went to another agency who was sending them children, Albertina Kerr was sending them children, and all of a sudden they had a child ready to come in there, and then they didn't bring it, and there's something in the record, and they would not let her see the record. That's the case of abuse. It was a beautiful home. One of the finest foster homes I've ever seen in this particular case, and in Mrs. Dyke's case, it was a beautiful home. And the above the average home that was taking foster children, and they don't take them, and they won't tell them why. They won't let them see the record, even to know why. Mrs. Dyke's was quite a few years ago, and this one, they were asking for the record as late as this last interim, and this is what... I told them that I was going to introduce a bill that was they'd have to show the records and let the people see why they took them.
How about an amendment in Section 5 that would accept an allegation of child abuse?
One that George and I were just talking about here a minute ago, maybe if we said except by order of the court. Now that you could have an ex parte order, which might not have proper showing. Except by order of the court, the Child Service Division shall not withdraw placement, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How about that? Does that sound right? Except by order of the court.
And then how does that cover if they just
still go
by children
back
to them if they just grant them? Would that cover that? Would the bill still cover that?
Yeah. You still go back into the hearing procedure. It would just be of an emergency nature where the child would be taken, and then there would still be a hearing.
Except by court order. Let's say on 31, if we took out the words without a court hearing, page 3, line 31, and put the words, except by court order, the, take out the first four words.
What and why are we doing an order rather than a hearing?
Well, I think you might have an order without a hearing. You get it after the
child.
Kind of
okay, yeah, so you need to hurry.
Right. Except by court order.
Right, the motion is on Senate Bill 696 to amend on page 3, line 31, and delete the words without a court hearing and substitute except by court order. Is there objection to the amendment?
Madam Chairman, I'd like to know what this amendment does to the last two lines of this section. It appears that this section deals with a special situation where the child is going to live with his parents. And it's not just a question of what's happened to the child, it's a question of...
Oh, I see.
And I don't see the connection between what we're talking about and what's in there.
That may be a hastily drawn amendment. Maybe we ought to have counsel look at it a little bit. I'll express the concern. The concern is that we not create a situation where a child, even though there's a claim of abuse or something, cannot be taken from a foster home except after a hearing. I think the court should have the authority, or based, although it might rarely use it, should have the power, based merely upon an affidavit or claim of possible abuse, to take the child from the home.
All right, Senator Cook withdraws his motion, and John, well, you see if you can draw an amendment to that effect. In other words, in an emergency situation that by court order a child can be removed, but that you still go back through the hearing procedure as far as the foster parents are concerned to determine what the problem was. Thank you, Representative Beck.
Protect these foster parents.
I hope you shape them up.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you shape them up, will you?
Shape who up?
Well, the children's services.
I'll do that.
Thanks for the
You didn't hear the disgraceful thing I did in the house this morning, did you?
Talk about it.
What did you do this morning, Dave?
Well, I voted against the condom bill yesterday, and I stood up and said that's an explanation. I thought that just decency was a better remedy. And besides, I hadn't seen anything in the bill where you had a worm around your neck in case you wanted them in a hurry, you know, and they weren't near a store. When they were kids, I did.
Great.
And this morning, I found
was
a
that printed in the journal?
Well, I don't know. No, I didn't write it up. And then they, you know, told me you didn't wear them around your neck and all. I said, well, I meant a string like used to wear an asthetic bag when I lived with my grandmother. This morning I found a gift on my desk, one on a string. I've got it around my neck, another one here. I got up under personal privileges.
No,
and I said, I wish you boys to know if you want them, I've got them.
Did you vote for the bill, Grace?
Did they recess immediately, Grace?
Oh, but we're in a very tense situation in the house.
Yeah, I know.
One of the worst we've ever been in, and it started a little ripple of laughter, too, even in the galleries and the press leaning over, and it kind of broke up what something that was real tense, but...
That just shows the end justifies the means, doesn't it?
Did you make sure, Senator Hart, that Representative Peck saw the headline in the Capital Journal the day after you carried the bill, which said, Solon Stretch Condom Outlet?
Anyway, I picked up the dare, and I bet you won't do that.
That puts us in the same bed, Jake.
I'll go put this to give this to. They put this
very hard. They're all preparing for it.
You're very tense,
Dave.
High five. God bless.
Is there a record show? Great thanks. I said this for Oyster Service.
I was through the Senate Bill 255. Senate Bill 255.
That's why they call it the lower house.
Do we have any amendments, John?
No, we don't.
Do you want to speak to anything, Keith?
Are you talking to me?
Mm-hmm.
Directly responsible to the floor to request examination of claims. Oh, yes, I'd like to move that to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
What's the name?
255.
255.
This is one, I think the, that's right.
There's another one, too, isn't there?
Do you want to speak to him?
Well, what it does is that you have a workman who is injured, and before he gets a determination, he dies for some reason other than the injury receiving the job. And therefore, if that occurs, under the present law, his family doesn't get any of the benefits that he'd be entitled to. And what this does, has the board go ahead and make a determination order. And there's a good case on this that shows that if a man loses both hands and therefore is permanently and totally disabled, then the family can get benefit if he died before a determination order, because he's permanently and totally disabled.
Yeah.
But if he loses one hand, he's only permanently partially disabled, then they get no benefits under the present law. And this would permit them to go ahead and make a determination and give the benefits to the family that he would have received if he survived. And that's all the bill does, and this was as a result of a Supreme Court decision. And have you got that case there?
I've got it.
And Justice Connell's dissent in there is probably the most telling argument in favor of the bill.
If there's an award for permanent total and he dies...
Well, even if he's entitled to permanent total.
If he's entitled to permanent total and he dies, his survivors get the award, but if it's partial, if it's permanent partial and he dies, they get none. And this would, in the case of a deceased employee from non-industrial means,
it would
eliminate the distinction, really.
That's right.
Well, I'll vote to send it out of committee, but I have a very basic conflict in my mind as to whether or not we're really talking about workman's compensation.
We're talking about life insurance.
Point. And so I'll vote
to
send it out.
Paid the insurance premium for the benefit.
Didn't pay for life insurance, he paid for accidents.
That's right.
And that's what's out of the whole damn system. We're paying for a lot of things that don't belong anywhere.
I'll vote to send it out, but I'll vote against it, probably. I read the case.
It's been moved that Senate Bill 225 be moved 255. It's got a misprint on it. It says 225 on one.
Oh, I know it does inside, but it's actually 255.
255 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Clerk call roll.
Senator John Gray.
Aye.
Senator Keith.
Aye.
Senator Cook.
Aye.
Senator Ivers.
No.
Senator Hoyt.
No.
Could we take up 677 now, Matt?
Well,
that's 237.
We're going to 21.
We're going
21. 21. Is this on the table, John, or not?
No, it was taken back off the table.
We amended
it. Madam Chairman, yes, and we amended it to make it a disputable presumption and also to require one of the parties to be a resident of this state for at least 1 year prior to the death of the other party.
The purpose of this bill, of course, Madam Chairman, is to see that people who have been living as man and wife and don't have a will, that the surviving spouse, the surviving party, would, under certain circumstances, be entitled to the benefits of retirement programs and such as that. And the amendment that we put in there changed it to where that you had to, if necessary, you had to prove the relationship and not just take it for granted, as I understand the amendment.
Well,
right.
The question remains in my mind, Madam Chairman, about the children. Now, if he had children from a prior marriage and he died intestate, under the present law, the children would get all of his estate. If this passes, then the common law wife would disinherit to the children to 50%. Right?
I think that's right.
Okay.
Is it, John?
Yep.
Is that what Mr. Hankey said?
Further discussion.
If I could read what Mr. Harrington said, I do not feel that the limited effect the bill might have on the children of the deceased parent, allocating the surviving part of the surviving spouse share of the estate, one half, constitutes sufficient reason to deny to the survivor the status and rights of the surviving spouse.
It's marked up.
It's an opinion, Dick. It's one Irishman against another.
Do we have the 1 year? It's a 1 year thing in there.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
You know, really, Ed, that really doesn't make any sense, does it?
Why?
The 1 year in there. And, oh, I know. The reason we put the 1 year in there so people wouldn't move to Oregon for the benefit of it, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the reason we did?
This has got a bona fide resident. You can't just come over here to get the benefit.
This is all right.
It doesn't, logically, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
make it, then make it into their bona fide residence for 30 days, but it isn't for a year.
Might be unconstitutional.
It may well be.
But that's not our job.
Give us lawyers something to do.
Yeah, I heard that remark today.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Well, that's the fourth time that remark.
I thought he was talking about you. You knew how good I was.
But you know he's right.
He told me Ivers and I were the only attorneys on this committee.
And you told him you were judges, not attorneys?
I said yes. Change your mind.
We're on 21, Bob. You may have seen that before. Further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Sir John Brin?
No.
Sir Keith Brin?
Aye.
Sir Cook?
Aye.
Sir Ivers?
No.
Sir Hoyt?
Aye.
Sir Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Senator Hoyt, I'll carry the bill. Senate Bill 237.
Motherhood and the family.
Do we have amendments, John?
No, we don't.
I move 237 with the floor of due pass of committee.
Want to speak to it?
Yeah, this is the one on joint supervision control. I distributed to the committee the testimony of an attorney by the name of Dan O'Leary, who testified before the Labor Committee on this subject. About 8 years ago, there were three states in the Union that had this doctrine in their statutes, and I believe they've all, and I'll stand corrected, but I believe they've all removed it now except Oregon. And the Oregon Supreme Court has had such a strict interpretation of this.
What's
that
case?
I don't know. Maybe Cliff Allison is looking over there. I hope he's got it. But there is one case where a milk truck went on to a farmer's property to pick up the milk, and the driver and an employee of the farmer got an altercation, and the milk truck driver got beat over the head with some instrument or something like that, and they said this was joint supervision and control because they both had workman's compensation, and therefore the milk truck driver didn't have an action against the farmer whose employee was acting in the course of employment or against the employee. You find that a lot of times where it occurs in deals where log truck drivers are coming into log dumps, and these are the more typical cases, and they pull up there, and there's some negligent act by the log dump operator by having some act of theirs that is negligent, and they say that the area is under joint supervision and control, and therefore they cannot recover against a third party for negligent act. Now, we've had a lot of discussion on the floor about the cost of workman's compensation. If anything, and I assume we're talking about such a small percentage of reduction that it probably won't even register, but if anything, it would reduce the cost of the workman's compensation premium, and to what effect this would have on the liability insurance premium of other employers, I don't know. I've got to have a broad policy anyway, and it probably would not affect it. But it's a deal where somebody other than the employer, of an employee, has caused the accident, and under our present law, that employee has no cause of action against the third party that has caused the injury, and this would eliminate that doctrine.
Now, I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Why is it going to reduce the safe other funds expenditures by $241,000?
Because they got that
because what they paid out in third party claims.
I didn't know that was in the book on that.
Well, that's in the budget now.
Okay. Well, then it has a greater effect than I said. I said it had a very small effect. Apparently, it has a greater effect than I thought, because they would be at the present time. State Accident Insurance Fund is recovering about $750,000, as I recall, in third party claims. And apparently this would add another $250,000. I didn't think it would have that impact.
It says it'll.
I didn't think it would.
Broaden the grounds for third party actions. It will raise third party income by a third.
Okay. Well, I'm surprised that's that great. I didn't think it was.
Well, I'm going to support it because I think that let them litigate directly with the tortfeasor, and to that extent, save the administrative costs.
I think Senator Keith Burns has moved to Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator John Burns.
Aye.
Senator Keith Burns.
Aye.
Senator Cook.
Aye.
Senator Ivory?
Aye.
Senator White?
No, I may vote for on the floor, but I want to say so.
Senator Chairman?
Aye.
Then I'm going to start practicing workman's comp law.
How
about my bill now?
Even the third Reich.
677,
Reich
allowed
this
kind
of
case.
Senator Hoyt is part of that, too.
Well, how about my bill?
Well, we'll get to yours after mine.
No, I don't want to get to my bill.
He's not here. 677. 677. This Senator Hoyt is very familiar with this because I stole this from him. Along with
it. If I knew about everything I'd lost, I'd feel bad. Oh, that's our old friend.
Yeah, that's our old friend. It's a good bill. 677. I don't think I was here the day of the hearing, but what it's designed to do is to further bring hopefully a higher level of justice to city courts. City charges, and what it does is to confer jurisdiction upon district courts to hear charges for the violation of municipal ordinances and charters. And I think this would clearly eliminate any doubt as to the constitutionality of the present law, which theoretically I thought was intended to allow the district court in Multnomah County to hear charges of violations of city ordinances so that we could have qualified judges hear these cases. This would give to the court the jurisdiction, and it would simply be a question of whether the city charter would permit it. Now, in the case of Troutdale, the city charter does permit it. In the case of Gresham, they're thinking of amending the charter so that if the city charter permitted it, they could then go to district court. And by the way, there's a committee working in Multnomah County, and they're well on their way to setting this up in Multnomah County so that if the cities want to, the district court sitting in Gresham would be able to hear violations of ordinances of the four or five small cities. So I think it's a very good bill, and Senator Hoyt originally introduced it last session. It passed the Senate, as I recall. You were on the committee, Betty. I remember it came out of our committee, went over the House, and died in a House committee.
It's still has statewide jurisdiction application.
Right, statewide application. I'd like to move that we send Senate Bill 677 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
This allows the city attorney to come into district court.
Senator Smith, we're on.
Our notes are passing by.
677.
You need it first.
Oh.
You get that better, you.
This is the bill you're talking about, Madam Chairman.
Yeah, I know.
No,
that better you.
That would come
well,
that.
Better note on the side.
That is if this bill gets out.
I asked her to give it to you to
out of the way.
It might work the other way.
I'm not confident. I'm talking about it.
Have you ever had a fiscal impact on this?
I've never had a lawyer being affected.
No, we haven't.
It
would seem to be that what can happen would be the cities would instruct all their policemen to cite into district court.
They'd get the fines that would be involved. And I think that most people who are interested in ultimate justice would favor this, because the fact of the matter is you often have city judges that don't know anything about law. And while it might cost a little bit more to the county, the people would have, or at least should have, if we assume that district court judges are qualified, would have a better shot at having a fair trial. That's the whole idea. Well, I think that there's tremendous merit in that position. However, there was testimony at the hearing concerning the fiscal impact this would have and the pressure to provide more district judgeships. I mean, that's where the fiscal impact comes out. It seems to me that the guy from Beaverton testified quite strongly against it. Is that not right?
If I'm not mistaken, that testimony wasn't on the traffic safety bill.
He's been here a dozen times. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
well, I don't know. The thing is now,
Gresham, they've arranged to have a local lawyer try the cases. They're not satisfied with that situation. I know that they want to have it all taken to district court. Troutdale, up to now, they really, our city recorder is willing to try the case, but she shouldn't be trying cases. We've arranged to have, because she doesn't, isn't a lawyer. We have arranged to have a lawyer come in whenever needed. Troutdale is a problem because the 1st of July, they're going to hire a full-time policeman. It isn't practical, really, to have a part-time judge, I don't think. I don't know. It just seems we're doing it now for Portland. Actually, all Portland ordinances are being tried at state expense, I presume. All that they get back, they don't get anything from Portland except whatever fines come in.
Well, I'm not too much concerned about Portland, Vern, but we had the pressure from two more district judges in Washington County, which we gave them last session. Now, they want another district judge for Washington County. Now we passed this, and they closed down the city court in Beaverton and Hillsboro in Washington County and want three more district judges. And there's a question in my mind concerning the saturation part as far as the ways and means are concerned, particularly if the district judge's salary goes anywhere near what is proposed in the salary bill, which is $29,000. I think that the question almost has to be considered in conjunction with, is they now they want a new district judge for Benton County. And I'm not mistaken, they want one for Jackson County.
I think they want two in Lane.
And I completely agree with your objective here, but I don't know how I can accommodate that, us short of sending it to Ways and Means, and I don't think we want to do that.
Is this self-financing?
Well, to a large extent, I would think it is. It's not completely proper, perhaps, but they're going to get the fines, whatever they are.
It's going to be split.
50-50. Just start to split 50-50. Question?
Clerk call roll.
Attorney John Gray?
No, at this time.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Ivory?
Aye.
Senator Hoyt?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman?
No. Bill fails. John, let's turn to 853.
Keith Burns is here. How would you vote, John?
Are you on my bill? On your bill?
Bill
I vote yes.
Fail.
Vote
right.
Yes.
No, I was there in the drawer. I wanted to vote, Madam Chairman.
Vote yes.
The committee objects to it.
I was in the room. I think one foot was in the room.
I move to reconsider.
Okay.
you didn't care about the bailing side.
I lost.
You just didn't vote, period.
No, I said I wanted to vote. I was standing right there in the doorway talking to somebody, and I deliberately stood in the doorway and didn't leave the room, so I'd be in the room and vote.
I move we suspend the rules and let them vote.
I move to
reconsider.
I intend to reconsider.
Is the Cook
Burns Coalition? The question is called for clerk call roll on reconsideration.
Senator John Burns?
Aye.
Senator Keith Burns?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Ivers?
Aye.
Senator Hoyt?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Aye.
Now I now move that the 77.
77.
Move it'll be sent to the floor to pass.
Senator Cook has moved that Senate Bill 677 be sent to the floor to pass. Clerk call roll.
Senator John Burns?
Negative.
Senator
Keith
Burns?
Affirmative. Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Ivers?
Aye.
Senator
Hoyt?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman?
I thought it passed by
no.
A
vote.
No.
Passed.
Send
the cook
carries
the bill.
Just
shows
the importance of
the
chairman having a
full attendance. Yes, right.
You're
right. 853, John. You asked for additional time to look at this. Are you ready on it yet?
Well, I haven't reached the point where I've changed my mind, but perhaps you have a sufficient number for your votes.
What one?
Mr. Hamill, do you wish it taken up today?
853?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I would.
853?
Does anybody on the committee wish to take action?
I'll read it through. Just a second here.
Okay.
Hold on. I thought you were talking about a different bill.
Oh,
quoted right this morning, Mr. Byrne, you're surely quoted for this. I moved it out, I moved the other day.
Okay, so Hoyt has moved it out, new path.
What does it do? Would someone argue this, because I haven't, wasn't here at the hearing, I don't know.
Well, I won't be able to practice law anymore.
It creates a trial board to hear disciplinary matters rather than the board of governors.
Board of governors acts as a grand jury and screens the complaints as they come in.
You can't charge fees.
Then it's sent to a trial committee made up of three persons, two of whom make the recommendation. The recommendation goes straight to the Supreme Court, not through the board of our governors.
Okay, and what's the argument in favor of it and against it?
That the board of our governors is overloaded and is not able to continue. And I believe they are using this practice at the present time, is that right?
I didn't understand the question.
Are the board of our governors now using trial, appointed trial panels?
Well, they've used appointed trial panels for a long while, but at the present time, their decision has to come back to the board of governors before it goes to the Supreme Court.
All right, this eliminates that, then going back to the board of our governors.
Is there an argument against it?
Well, you know how the bar treats sole practitioners as opposed to large firms. I'm going to vote for it. I'm the target.
I have a conflict. I'm a lawyer.
Well, I know Tom wasn't. No, I was on the
committee.
You had
a conflict on the committee. Fine. I was on the committee. Fine. I was on the committee.
I'll have to tell him I was on the committee. Maybe you will say that again.
All right, who calls for the question? Senator Smith does.
I don't know what he's talking about.
Kirk, call roll.
Smith and I are clean. We know damn well what we're going to talk.
Aye.
Senator Cook.
Aye.
We're getting this started.
Aye.
Senator Hoyt?
Aye.
No. Madam Chairman?
Aye. Bill passed. Who wants to carry it?
Why, I don't.
I think Senator John Burgo carries the bill.
I'd be happy to carry it.
Let Senator Smith carry it.
All right, well, let Senator Smith.
You know, he came within one vote of defeating that other farm bill today.
He found out who his friends were.
All right, let's look at 713.
Cook, you ought to come more often. We'll have more fun today with Hatcher Reese.
713?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody must not like it. Look at that.
Hey, I'm for this reason. I just didn't think you were good enough for this kind of life.
No. Do we have any amendments, John?
Well, no, we don't, Madam Chair.
These are different bills, so do we.
Anybody wish to take action on
Senator Hoyt moved before the Duke passed
recommendation. Senator Hoyt moved before the Duke passed recommendation.
Well, now, what is this? Let me see here. Come on.
Just a little minor bill.
Minor bill.
He's going to trip him over the chicken.
He's caught up.
Huh? If you make a mistake, he's dead duck. I lost a good used to one time that way.
That worked my last signature.
Well, now, who says, why do we have to put this in here? Is there anything that says they have to have a consent now?
Well, what they do, they have a cause of action for loss of consortium to get the doctor.
Well, I see. You just cut yourself out of some business.
Yeah,
what's wrong with
yet.
You practicing attorney.
It's a good bill.
Further discussion. Clerk, call roll.
Senator Johnson?
No.
Senator Keith?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
I'm going to abstain.
Senator Ryder?
No.
Senator Hoyt?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Let me count.
Sure.
Count, Leslie. You're a little short.
3-2.
That's right.
In favor or
against?
Are you still abstaining?
I'm still abstaining. You know what I can do for you?
Do I get one?
You've done it already. I dropped two on the table right now. That's enough.
I vote no and give notice of possible reconsideration.
Go for it. I give my boys Christmas presents.
Well, I haven't even thought about this.
Yes. Well, there'll be a time.
Well, it isn't tabled or anything.
We got to know the possible reason.
We can reconsider it.
Oh, yeah.
Let's turn
next
to
session.
163.
Leslie, are you the one that types up this order of business? Can't you start from the low number and go through without just jumping around?
Well, half of the bill is including land we considered, not even on it.
The book is going to be worn out.
Just glad to have Cook here. Everybody wants to see him board.
I sure wish I had some bills this session.
Then you got to get a whole Cook here besides.
Are there amendments to 163?
Yes, there are, Madam Chairman. The ad hoc committee that you appointed or got together to iron out the differences between the proponents and opponents of this bill have got together. You should find in your packet, under this particular bill, two mock-ups with amendments in them. I think either Charlie Williamson, who would represent the proponent of the bill, probably explain the amendments as well or better than I can, or Mr. Biggs, who is, represents the opponents. There are amendments that all parties have agreed to, and there are amendments to which they still disagree. And these amendments are in concrete form at this time.
I move the amendments that they agree on.
Laird, are you prepared to take Charlie? Oh, Charlie, you're here. Okay, and Mr. Biggs, if you want to come up. Can you, would you come up to the table, too?
Madam Chairman,
yes.
To me.
Senator Burns.
I know that Senator Hoyt shares my respect for Mr. Biggs, known him for many years and everything, and I
share it as well.
Well, I'm sure everybody here with me does. But
are you trying to?
The only point I want to.
You're looking for a job.
A job.
You like my name to you?
Go back ahead. You come to me. No, I just wanted to the committee to know that there's been complete communication between the people who've been working on this. There's been open, complete communication on all the amendments, and everybody's put forth a lot of effort on both sides to make sure there was communication. We know what we agree on and what we don't agree on.
I think that's exactly right.
Okay, I want Senator Hoyt to know that because he's concerned, and I want to reassure
him. That's why I moved the amendments to agree on. Let's get them on to the nitty-gritty.
Is there a mock-up here?
You knew it already.
Mm-hmm. I just know that they agreed on part of it, and I'm going to get that out of the way. I'm not going to read it. I wouldn't understand.
The packet contains a mock-up.
Right.
What
did you say with me?
Well, now, wait a minute.
There should be two mock-ups, one which includes in it the amendments that have been agreed upon as well as those that have not been agreed upon, another which contains those that have been agreed upon, and that's indicated on the top of the mock-up.
One's proposed amendments agreed upon?
Yes.
And there are some others in addition to those that have not been agreed upon?
Yes.
Mr. O'Leary? Can you pull that chair over there?
Thank you.
Wow.
What do you have, Mr. O'Leary?
I have here copies for the committee of a statement commenting upon Mr. Williamson's letter to the committee in relation to the amendments in his letter.
So, Larry, do you want to state your name and your position?
I'm Prentiss O'Leary. I am an attorney from Los Angeles that represents the JCPenney Company. I've been working on SB 163 in relation with the Oregon Retail Council and Associated Oregon Industries. The statement is primarily in relation to those amendments which we have not agreed upon and focuses primarily upon a case decided last week in the United States Court of Appeals, Second District, which is in New York.
Second, did you say circuit or?
The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Right? In a case entitled Eisen v. Carlisle and Jacqueline, which is a very famous class action litigation which has been pending for some 6+ years, and this is a decision which ruled the action was not properly maintainable as class action.
Well, Madam Chairman,
don't
the amendment specifically provide for the court to determine that early in the proceeding?
Yes.
So that wouldn't be appropriate here. I mean, that doesn't have any effect on these.
Well,
right?
The ruling has a big effect in relation to those amendments that were not agreed upon, in that, in fact, one of the amendments not agreed upon is expressly commented upon in the opinion.
Is that the appellate to be able to appeal the trial court?
No. The federal courts, you can do that. We have no limitation in regard to that in federal court. The derivation of the interlocutory appeal procedure that is in the amendments, we'll call the agreed upon amendments, is derived from the federal interlocutory appeal procedure. The some of the proceedings, I have 7 copies of our statement with the case.
Mr. O'Leary, to which of the not agreed upon amendments does the Eisen case address itself to?
In part, in all 3 of them. If we divide the not agreed upon amendments to first, the point that damages, or that the court in determining the maintainability of the class action should consider whether the return to the individual members of the class will be so minimal as not to warrant intervention in the court. The second amendment would be that amendment allowing the trial court to determine that justice would be more efficiently served by maintenance of the action under the federal rule provision B2 as opposed to a B3 action. I think that relates to section 2C, primarily an equitable proceeding as opposed to damages, as Mr. Biggs states. And the third amendment would be that term, the opt-in or affirmative action type of provision. And
the Eisen case address itself to that?
It addresses itself to one of the major concerns which forces potential defendants, which forces Mr. Biggs on behalf of his clients and myself, on behalf of my clients and the AOI, to be so concerned about class actions as they've been interpreted under Rule 23 and what is known as the fluid recovery theory. The Eisen case directs itself rather extensively to that theory, and in relation to that, states in fairly unequivocal terms, if I can find it quickly now. States that it's unconstitutional deprivation of or violation of due process of law. I believe that that's about.
The Eisen case says that?
It does. We can turn to. I seem to. Did I pass out the wrong?
No,
did I give you one that had those marks on it? I may have passed that, but. Let's see here. I think I can find it in this anyway. We find in relation to the fluid recovery theory.
You want to explain what the fluid recovery theory is?
Yes.
2A.
Let me ask a question before we go into
that. Senator John Brennan.
Would this matter be completely resolved between the proponents and the opponents if we put in a substitute bill which would adopt federal rule of civil procedure as the civil procedural code of the state of Oregon?
He's all the way outside proponents.
I'm sorry. Put in a substitute bill which would put the, which would give us the federal rules.
No, that would resolve one of the questions that we've talked about. It would give the procedural flexibility that's necessary to handle any kind of a class action, but it would not affect the opt-in procedure. The opt-in procedure that we think is so very essential to make any class action an appropriate proceeding is not presently included in the federal rules. It was originally. They adopted the present federal rule, leaving that out, and that is the thing that has now brought the class action rule in the federal court under such serious controversy and into some disrepute. The American College of Trial Lawyers have carefully considered that and have come up with amendments which would include the opt-in procedure that hasn't yet been adopted by the Supreme Court.
In order for us to move along, I think the fastest way in this handout material is to turn to the page which is behind page 10 and which is entitled a cut and paste job. And it sets forth where there is agreement and where there is not agreement. The first one, common questions of law or fact is agreed upon. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And so then we proceed to E, the likelihood of damages to be recovered by individual class members if judgments for the classes entered are so minimal as not to warrant the intervention of the court.
The proponents of the bill do not agree to that. The opponents of the bill do not agree to that. In case you want to know where we stand on that.
Yes, it so indicates on the sheet.
Keith
Burns.
In other words, what you're saying is that the opponents, as you're classified here now, and sake of distinguishing,
do not agree to this amendment.
Now, look, the opponents generally are opposed to what's going on in the federal court, though, right?
That is correct.
You're opposed to the opt-out procedure, that present law in the federal court, under the federal rules of civil procedure, right?
Well,
You
put it that way. We're opposed to the lack of necessity of any affirmative action to bring members into the class. That's what we're opposed to. Now, the federal rule now does not require that.
It does not require an opt-in procedure.
Affirmative action. Now, this one deals with the fluid recovery thing. If it's so minimal, the court shouldn't be.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Under Keith
Burns. So, you're talking about maybe a dollar a person.
Mm-hmm.
And so some companies enrich themselves. They got 100,000 persons. Mm-hmm. So they're unjustly enriched to the tune of $100,000.
All right.
So why should they keep that $100,000?
Well,
and besides that, in the amendments. The amendments provide that they have to give notice beforehand, and if the corporation or whoever it is says, you're right, we shouldn't keep that, and we're going to pay back that money, then there's no cause of action, there's no attorney's fees, there's no cost, you don't have to pay interest on the money you kept. What can be fairer than that?
Well, let me just say this.
Mr. Banks.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
we respect that. Sometimes slave master, but I don't know.
Am I free to address a reminder? I think your arguments could appropriately be addressed to the court in any consideration of a class action. If that's the kind of an argument you want to make, you may persuade the court that this is an action nevertheless. Regardless of the fact that only a dollar per person is involved, to justify the court's intervention. But he is not required to, and it's one of the things that he should take into consideration. Let's take another extreme. Suppose there may be only 2 or 3 cents involved among a million people. Now, the way to get at that is not to bankrupt the defendant if, in fact, he is found to be guilty, but it's to enjoin him from continuing to do it, or to resolve a situation of that kind by another kind of a statute. You can have a criminal statute. You can have a liquidated damage statute or a penalty statute that would provide the punishment that a guilty defendant, if he is guilty under these circumstances, is entitled to. But to permit it to be done in a civil action of the magnitude of some of these class actions, with the minimal amount so small that no individual member of the class is interested, is just overburdening the courts with a with a tremendous amount of labor and providing a class representative with a cudgel that will force a settlement against the defendant who denies that he's guilty but can't possibly afford to incur the expense and the risk of defending that kind of thing. That's the problem. That, I mean, that's our position.
Senator Keith Burns, do you want to make an appropriate motion?
Well, I'd move the amendments that have been agreed upon. All right, I'll move the amendments that are not agreed upon.
We haven't passed them.
We haven't passed the other.
You're moving an amendment to an amendment.
Yes.
He's a real mover.
I'm just trying to accommodate the chairman to get this where she wants to have it so we can discuss it.
She didn't place up my motion.
Yeah, we haven't passed that.
All right.
Well, I move an amendment to your amendment.
We take Senator Hoyt's motion to move the amendment, and then yours is an amendment to the amendment.
Right.
Mine was to adopt the amendments that were agreed upon.
Okay, and I'm amending that to include those that have not been agreed upon.
But which ones?
Well, now, Senator, in all fairness to you, I rather would like that, because I think that most of the amendments...
Oh, they're yours.
I think they are. I think that we would think all of the proposed amendments would be necessary to make it a...
I withdraw my motion.
...class action, and I didn't want you to misspeak yourself in all fairness.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chairman, may we have a vote on Senator Hoyt's motion, and then we can go on.
We haven't heard from Mr. Williamson yet. You heard the motion, Mr. Williamson, the amendments that were agreed upon. Do you have any comments?
No. I might just say that I think that these amendments that we agreed upon do solve the problems that have been brought out about the abuse of class actions in federal court. They provide for a pre-filing notice when you have to give a defendant 30 days notice before you bring a class action. He can remedy the situation. He doesn't have to go through the adverse publicity of the lawsuit. They limit attorney's fees. They throw out any possible minimum damages that might be, that has been a subject of abuse in federal court. They provide several other procedures. There's a provision for a hearing on page...
I'll vote. I'm going to be right here on the phone.
Page 3 of the bill. On the cut and paste job at the top of the second page, cut and paste job. After a preliminary hearing, the oral determination by the court the probability of sustaining the claim or defense is minimal, that the class can be dismissed if the court makes that final.
Are you suggesting that is analogous to the summary judgment procedure?
It's a minor subject.
I have one other question, Madam Chairman, and that relates to the discovery procedures which we have in the federal rules, which are rather extensively more broad than what we have under our code, and it seems to me that those are important ingredients of class action. For both sides, really.
We would love to have them. Well,
but they're not in here. All right. Now.
Wait, John, what's not in there? I'm sorry.
The summary judgment, discovery, and finally, you've got the complex jurisdictional rule or whatever it is in the federal funders.
Complex multiple litigation.
Yeah.
We don't have that.
No.
Wait a minute.
There are coordination of action provisions for the same questions of law and fact.
Complex.
Well, but also with respect to the venue, they got amendments in there to take care of that the judge can decide where the case ought to be for the convenience of the party. That's included in the amendment.
All right, Jeremy. If we adopt the amendments that are agreed upon, then are there further amendments which you wish us to consider? You agree that the bill will be in proper shape if we adopt the amendments that are agreed upon?
Yes.
I move the amendment.
So they were already moved by Senator Hoyt.
All right, is it further discussion?
Well, one question.
Senator Smith.
And am I to assume that the further amendments that are not agreed upon are the amendments that Mr. Biggs and Mr. O'Leary are presenting, and that should they not be adopted, they would oppose Senate Bill 163 as amended by the first.
Correct, Senator. Correct.
Mr. Williams.
I think I should point out that all of the amendments were originally proposed by Mr. O'Leary and the opponents of the bill. All of the agreed upon amendments are the ones that we've worked out.
That you can't agree upon.
All the ones we can't agree upon.
Well, then, Madam Chairman, I wish to amend Senator Hoyt's motion to include first the amendments that have not been agreed upon, presented by Mr. Biggs and Mr. O'Leary.
Right.
It's the only way that I can properly get the question.
Now, will you point out to us, please, one at a time, where they are, the ones that you don't agree upon?
Could I ask a question, Madam Chairman?
Senator Petersburg.
Would the bill be in proper form if we adopted the motion to amend along with the motion to amend the amendment? Would the bill be in proper form?
Not
according to Mr. Williams.
No, I'm not talking about whether they agree on the principle.
What you're saying is if all of the amendments
that have not been agreed upon, if they are put in there now, along with the ones that have been agreed upon, they're put in there now, in the present form, is the bill proper?
The bill in itself is proper, but it's unworkable without the procedural things that we need. Now,
is that part of your amendment?
Are there any amendments we have before us on the procedural things?
This is an argument.
This is a difference of opinion you have, though, between your opponents and proponents on it being workable, isn't it?
Well, I think, Senator, that most of us, I presume, I'm sure the proponents of the bill, too, are glad to know that the rulemaking power vested in the Supreme Court bill had passed the House. And from just what we've heard, we assume that it may receive a friendly reception of the Senate. If this bill were passed with all of the amendments, and subject to also the adoption of the procedural rule that's embodied in the House bill, then I think we would have a workable situation. That's what I think.
Well, point of clarification.
Senator Smith.
Then I assume, as in pursuing Senator Burns' question before, the point is either or at this time. It's either the amendments proposed by Mr. Biggs and Mr. Laird, or the amendments proposed in the first motion.
I guess we're speaking really as to form. Are we not?
The amendments agreed upon are one set of amendments, and then the ones not agreed upon go further.
That is correct. That is correct.
I misunderstood, Mr. Biggs.
Yes, I confused you, Senator, because the question was, would the bill be in a complete form? And the answer to that would be yes. That didn't overcome all of the objections that I would have to the bill because of the procedural problem, but the need in enforcing the bill of having a more flexible procedure. That's all.
This is involved in the rulemaking policy of the Supreme Court, which is in another bill.
That is correct. Right.
We've got the most special
rulemaking.
One second.
The amendment to the motion includes the opt-in procedure,
right,
which, as I understand it, proponents feel that there's little use in having a class action bill if you're going to have an opt-in procedure. And this was a statement I read to the committee earlier, because of the nature of the plaintiffs, that they're scattered far and wide a long time before the riots, a lot of time you're talking about with the indigent poor, and so forth, and they ordinarily do not respond to something that looks a little more than a handbill put at their door that's may allow. And that's a big problem. And Charlie?
May I just say one example? I'm a senator, and I don't mean to argue with you about it, but the necessity of having some kind of affirmative action, some opt-in procedure. Now, this is a bizarre situation, but it actually occurs. any class action case that we have before Judge Bologna, which involved the credit card situation. A notice was sent out to all credit card holders. When we came on for a consideration before him on a pretrial consideration of whether the class action should be maintained, and we were discussing the effect of the notice, it suddenly occurred to him, I'm a credit card holder. What should I do about this? I wasn't asked to opt in, but so I must therefore be a member. Well, that disqualifies me, doesn't it, from hearing this case. So at the last moment, he then took the affirmative action of opting out. That wouldn't have been the situation at all. And this is a federal judge, if you please. That wouldn't have been the situation at all if there had been affirmative need, or a need in the beginning for an affirmative action of all who received notice of that to say whether they were going to be in the class or out of the class.
Mr. Williamson?
I think Mr. Kirkpatrick would like to make a statement on the opt-in and opt-out.
Briefly, please.
As Shirley pointed out, all the amendments were proposed by the opponents of the bill, and we worked out and tried to agree on everything that could possibly be agreed upon to make a fair bill and to reduce any possibility of abuse. But the one thing that just really is impossible to agree upon, and that's why it's really been thrown to the committee for the decision, is this opt-in, opt-out question, because to have an opt-in procedure would just cut out the heart of a class action bill. Everything else would work out a fair balance with the opt-in would just cut the heart out of the bill, especially as far as low-income consumers go. I think. And when I testified on the bill previously, I described the two cases that we've had. There have only been three consumer class actions that have gone very far in the Oregon courts. Two of them were from our program. One was the vacuum cleaner and 1,000 vacuum cleaner purchasers. The court found that the sales techniques were fraudulent and deceptive. The other case was the overcharge of the debtors by a debt consolidating agency. In both cases, the trial court applied, especially Endeavor Deuces, applied the opt-out provision, following the federal rules in this case, is already precedent in Oregon for the opt-out provision. This is what's used by all 50 states. If it had been an opt-in provision, the debtors that the court repeatedly found were overcharged, but there was illegal conduct against them, would never have gotten any recovery. So there just had been they just would not have joined in. Most debtors, or most low-income consumers, are afraid of the law. I mean, what they get through the mail from the court are notices of garnishment, things like this. They'd be very frightened if they received a notice in the mail, you are notified that you are part of a class suit and you're going to be bound by this litigation. They wouldn't. Many of them are illiterate. Many of them are frightened of these types of court papers. There'd be nobody to explain the procedure to them. For example, in the debt reducer's case, the manner in which the debt consolidating agency was overcharging these people was very complex. There's no way that could have been explained in a notice to these debtors. And because it couldn't have been explained in a court-ordered notice to the debtors, there'd been no way that they would have had sufficient information to opt in or take any other action. You just could not explain the basis of that suit. Yet the court found that this method of charging debtors was fraudulent, was overcharging, was violating Oregon law. And yet if you had an opt-in provision, those debtors would have been denied their right to get the money back. The court found they'd been illegally taken from them.
Madam Chairman?
I think Senator
Hoyt has. Well, yes, Madam Chairman. I really haven't fully digested this, but as I see it, there are two general areas of disagreement. And both of them are proposed by the proponents. My question is, if the committee were to adopt the contested amendments on the first page and the second page, and did not adopt the amendments as proposed by the opponents on the fourth and fifth pages, would we have a workable bill? And somehow this makes sense to me. Now, somebody explain to me why it doesn't.
You're omitting the opt-in.
Well, I guess I am. I want the judges to be involved in deciding whether it's capricious or fancy word.
Yeah.
May I address myself to the question?
Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Hoyt, committee members, I think that each one of those three areas, or the first two areas, should be separately considered. I think that the first two are really more procedural in nature and not that important to us, but I think that the Eisen opinion here substantiates the need for that as to the possible consequences of allowing a class action to go on for 5 years without facing these issues. These are some of the very issues involved in this particular case, and give a little background, in 1968, the same court, the same judges, same panel, issued a decision which is popularly known as Eisen 2, which has, to a large extent, caused much of the defendants, the potential defendants, representing difficulty with Rule 23, the implementation and interpretation of that decision, the language in there. They indicated that Rule 23 should be liberally construed in favor of maintainability of class action. Here we find some 1973, what, 5 years later, the court says this action may not be maintained as a class action and goes through a lot of reasons for that, which we feel are valid. And we get down to the point where this time has passed, the class has received nothing. Those people who may have relied upon the class action being pending are probably out of luck now, if they were members of the odd lot class from 62 to 66. I think that those particular issues are approached by those first two amendments, when you have this large class that is basically unmanageable unless you engage in certain procedures that will affect constitutional rights. I refer you to page 2833. Now, if we turn to the opt-in procedure, what we're looking at in that amendment is, to us, the most important part of getting involved. There have been some cases that, by way of settlement, that have been approved by the courts, and some public enforcement cases where you've had a public agency involved that have adopted what has been termed the fluid recovery theory. And this is where you have prospective benefits to the class. The potentiality of that type of recovery by way of judgment has caused a great deal of fear. Therefore, we think there should be some affirmative action on members of the class. The court, in the Eisen opinion, recognizes that Rule 23 is not particularly well adapted for a class action for damages where you have exceedingly large classes, but that its technique is adapted where the members of the class, the number of members of the class, are controllable and limited in number. Now, they don't leave the issue of what about the defendant who's gotten his ill-gotten gain, so-called. They approach that, and they make some suggestions, and they discuss the issue. But they indicate that you can't solve it in Rule 23 in regard to your $1 case by making amendments to it without affecting constitutional rights. Now, we think that the affirmative action thing, and people have been talking about opt-in, but a careful reading of this indicates that it's an alternative. First, that you will be excluded from the class unless you request inclusion. Or the court may elect to tell in the notice that you will be included in the class unless you request exclusion, in other words, opt out. But under that alternative, the language reads, each member who does not request exclusion shall file by a specified date a statement in the form therein prescribed, court control, of the loss or injury. Now, that doesn't mean dollar amount. He doesn't have to engage in parallel equations to determine what the specified dollar amount is. It could be that the form prescribed by the court could be in the nature of a questionnaire.
I'm going to treat Senator Hoyt's request as a request to divide the question on the amendment to the amendment. Now, the first one is on this cut and paste job on page 3 on line 10, Mr. Biggs' amendment that the damages may be so minimal as not to warrant the intervention of the court. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator John Boone?
Aye.
Senator Keith Boone?
No.
Senator Cook?
No.
Senator Ivers?
Aye.
Senator Hoyt?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Sherman?
No. Motion carries. The next not agreed upon is...
Madam Chairman, I'm lost on that. Is that amendment approved?
Yes, it is. The next one is on the next page in subsection 3. The court shall, Mr. Biggs' amendment, that the court shall consider whether justice in the action would be more efficiently served by maintenance of the action as a class action. The court call the roll.
Senator John Byrne?
Aye.
Senator Tuesday?
No.
Senator Cook?
No.
Senator Ivan?
Aye.
Senator Boyce?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
No. The motion carries. On the next page is the opt-in, opt-out provisions. Mr. Biggs suggested amendment that a member of the class would have to opt in to be a member of the class.
Madam Chairman, I have a question on this.
Having
adopted the previous two amendments,
yeah.
Doesn't the judge have some jurisdiction or input on these latter parts?
Yes, yes, he does, Senator. The notice that's given shall be the notice in the, given in the discretion of the court, and he then must give notice, but the form of the notice is his discretion, and this is outlined what it is. The notice shall, in the discretion of the court, advise each member that unless by a specified date he does such and such and so and so. So in some cases, the court might be persuaded by Senator Byrne's argument that that the notice isn't necessary.
Well, Madam Chairman, I'm still quite clear. In case we did not adopt the amendment that we're maybe talking about, there still would be some control over the activity, even if this amendment was not adopted.
Well, I don't think that's true. The amendment itself imports discretion to the court.
You still have the minimal damages and so on that the court is able to...
You have minimal damages, but that means that he doesn't maintain the action at all.
Yes, right.
Where he does maintain the action and holds it should be maintained, then the question, and it's a very important question, is what notice shall he give to the defendants of the pendency of this, of the members of the class, of the pendency of this action? And this, then, we think should require affirmative action. The amendment as phrased here says that such a notice should be given. The Constitution requires that. You don't have due process unless they all are notified. Then the amendment says the notice shall, in the discretion of the court, advise each member either that he opts in or he opts out.
I'm sorry, my point, Madam Chairman, was if we didn't adopt these final amendments, well, just a minute, please. Couldn't the judge just say do this or do not do this in his own discretion?
I doubt that he could. I think that he needs guidelines on it.
The matter before us is to opt in or opt out. Does anybody feel they need a further information before voting on the question?
Do you have a chance for discussion?
You want to answer that?
Well, several of the people were supposed to leave.
Very briefly.
Yeah. Yes?
All right. I just want to point out that there's no requirement for any notice under Rule 23 prior to filing an action. We've built that in here. There's no opt-in, opt-out thing in the Rule 23 in the federal court either. And this, as far as I'm concerned,
Senator,
just a minute, please.
As far as I'm concerned, to adopt this amendment is to defeat the whole class action in the state of Oregon, because it just does not work if you require people to opt out. You've all received these things. You probably threw them in the waste basket and forgot about it. The Attorney General has filed class actions where practically every citizen in the state of Oregon. And it just, nobody responds. And it just defeats the whole thing.
The question before us is,
Madam Chairman, I removed the previous question.
The question before us is Mr. Biggs' amendment that a member of the class be required to opt in if he so desires. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator John Byrne?
I would have voted aye.
Senator Keith Byrne?
No.
Senator Cook?
No.
Senator Ivers?
Aye.
Senator Boyce?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
No, the amendment carries.
Madam Chairman, do we have one more part to vote on that?
Yes, we do. On the last page, section 5. Does this relate to the same thing, the opt-in, opt-out?
It's really inconsequential into the other one.
Madam Chairman, I would...
Senator Hoyt.
I would like to request that if I'm a swing vote, and let's face the issue here, I would like to not have a final vote today. I have contacted the Attorney General's office, and I didn't realize this was coming up today, but I knew it was coming up soon. And he is sending me some material, and sending to the clerk of the council committee, and I'm of the opinion that a good deal of what we've already adopted, except the last one particularly, is in his recommendation. I'd like to see that, because I'm not sure I'm satisfied with my final vote on this, but I don't want to leave this thing on fire.
Several members said they had to be away at 3 o'clock. We need to get it for the meeting as adjourned.